From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. This next interview we're about to air focuses on one of the most provocative and dangerous words in the American vernacular, the N-word. The conversation you're about to hear tackles the controversy around the word and necessarily involves the mention of the N-word in its entirety repeatedly from my guest. If such language disturbs you and offends you, you may want to tune out. The U.S.'s system of mass incarceration and racialized poverty go hand in hand. Black Americans are disproportionately criminalized and fill the prison system. While many on the left liberal part of the political spectrum chalk this up to a racist justice system, not enough link it to the prevalence of poverty in non-white communities. My guest, Jody Armour, has written a new book with an explosive title where he makes those links and calls for a rethinking of race, language, justice, and the law. Jody Armour is the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Law at the University of Southern California. His earlier book was called Negrophobia and Reasonable Racism, The Hidden Costs of Being Black in America. He's also a Soros Justice Senior Fellow of the Open Society Institute Center on Crime, Communities, and Culture, and the Race and Criminal Justice Correspondent for our program. He joins me to discuss his new book, whose subtitle is Race, Language, Unequal Justice, and the Law. Welcome, Jody, and please start by telling us the title of your book and why you chose to name it that way.
Yes, thanks very much for having me, Sonali. And this book actually addresses the issues we've talked about through the years, you and I, that keep rising in the headlines, keep coming up like a, you know, kind of Injustice Groundhog Day over and over. And I'm going to try to address some of those kind of perennial concerns. I do try to address some of them in this book. It's titled Nigger Theory. I use that blood-soaked epithet advisedly. I understand that many people find that to be a form of even hate speech, that it's a word that has deep roots in a racist American past, and as often accompanied violence toward Black bodies. And so I approach it with all of that understanding and with all of that freight in mind. I also recognize, though, that there are some Black writers and artists and other people who have been very thoughtful and used the word, reappropriated the word, inverted, transvalued the word as part of an oppositional discourse. Often an oppositional political discourse. And it can be used that way. People like, let's say Dave Chappelle, Richard Pryor, The Last Poets, Tupac Shakur, Nas, Cube, Ice Cube, Jay-Z. You know, there's a list of, a significant list of N-word virtuosos, if you will. That is artists, Black artists, who've used the word to attack the characterization of some Blacks as niggas, because it was, Sonali, after all, one of the other inspirations for the title of this book comes from Chris Rock's infamous routine that launched his comedic career in 96 in a routine called Bring the Pain, in which he goes back, walks back and forth in front of an all-Black audience and says essentially this: it's like a civil war going on in Black America, and there's two sides. There's Black people and there's niggas, and niggas have got to go. I love Black people, but I hate niggas. Boy, I wish they let me join the Ku Klux Klan. Should I do a drive-by from here to Brooklyn? He goes on like that for half an hour, and his core definition of a so-called nigger, Sonali, is a morally condemnable Black criminal, a Black person who's done crime, essentially, when you go through his examples. And so by that definition, the up to 90% of young Black males in some of these inner city neighborhoods are going to wind up in jail, on probation, or on parole at some point in their lives are niggas. Are we willing to condemn that fraction, that portion of our own community, of the youth of our own community, to that stigmatized status? We should say hell no, but we've been saying hell yes through the 90s, through the aughts, when people like Bill Cosby and other Blacks were supporting this politics of respectability-based distinction between good and bad Negroes. And I'm saying in this book, this is a moment in which we need to put this to rest for good and never again allow ourselves to distinguish between so-called good Negroes and bad Negroes or so-called lovable black people and morally condemnable niggas.
The book has an introduction by Melina Abdullah, who is a well-known Black Lives Matter activist based in Los Angeles, and also the introduction is written by Larry Krasner, the Philadelphia district attorney, who is progressive in his views on the criminal justice system. And I want to read for our audience the first sentence of your first chapter, where you say the jagged edges N-words, unparaphrasable power can focus attention on the strong but irrational and unreliable urge to morally condemn violent black criminals, and it can also invite law-abiding people to stand in political solidarity with such criminals. Well, what do you mean by that political solidarity? Who is the audience that you are saying needs to have this political solidarity?
First and foremost, I think across the board, I'm arguing for a radical reset in our mentality when it comes to all criminals and all people caught up in the criminal justice system. But I'm first and foremost aiming this at any and everyone who says they want to make deep cuts in mass incarceration. That's a lot of people. And I'm saying any of you who say that what you want to do is make deep cuts in racialized mass incarceration, you have to, for one thing, abandon the liberal Jim Crow narrative that you've been operating by for a while now, maybe 10 years or more now. What I mean by the liberal new Jim Crow narrative is the one made popular by Michelle Alexander's book by the same title, The New Jim Crow, in which she says we went from 300,000 in 1980 people in prison to 2.2 million by the time we get to the mid to late aughts, by the government arresting and convicting mostly low-level nonviolent drug offenders. That's what she said. And John Pfaff pointed out a couple of years ago that the fact of the matter is that's wrong. That when he looked at the state system in which 87% of the prisoners reside, only 5 to 6% of them were there for anything that could be characterized as a low-level nonviolent drug offense. And that was probably an inflated number. When I take my students to San Quentin, I don't see any low-level nonviolent drug offenders. I wouldn't say there's none there. I've never seen them. So that is not really what the problem mass incarceration is about. It's about violent offenders and serious offenders. So if you want to make deep cuts in racialized mass incarceration, you're going to have to overhaul your moral framework and moral compass. If the problem were just low-level nonviolent drug offenders, then Michelle Alexander's right. You wouldn't be asking people to make much of a change in their moral compass and moral framework, because we would be saying, oh, low-level nonviolent drug offenders, they're just like us. They haven't done anything that bad. You know, why should we go around condemning them? When you're saying, no, this person committed a violent assault, a murder, a serious crime, and so they aren't so easily sympathetic in that way, and still we have to find a way to find in them the possibility of redemption, restoration, rehabilitation, and not, as we have been for 30 years, approach them in the spirit of retribution, retaliation, and revenge. That's kind of what I'm getting at.
So it sounds as though you're sort of referring to the politics of respectability, which is often something that I've heard other people critique. It also reminds me of some of the conversations, the immigrant justice movement, where there's been this attempt by politicians to distinguish between the good immigrant and the bad immigrant in order to justify who can be let into the country. Is that along the lines of what you kind of were referring to?
Yeah, the politics of respectability is the idea that it's important in the Black community that we look good in the eyes of whites so that we'll get favorable treatment by white policy decision makers when they're balancing cost and benefits and making broad policy judgments. And so it's important for us to maintain a good racial reputation. And the way you maintain a good racial reputation is by clearly distinguishing and distancing yourself as good, responsible Negroes from those who are bad Negroes. And you make it clear that good Negroes are not to be lumped together with bad Negroes in the eyes of whites so that you'll get more favorable treatment for the Black community as a whole. That's the idea behind respectability politics. It was a motivating kind of principle in the civil rights movement in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. It may have had a place and a time, but that time has come and gone. The Black Lives Matter movement made it real clear that they weren't playing respectability politics when it came to these victims of police brutality. Many times these victims of police brutality would be questioned as to their character. You know, well, why was he selling Lucy's? He was engaging in a criminal act. Or Walter Scott, you know, wasn't keeping up with his child support payments when he ran away from the police officer. One of the things that Black Lives Matter activists made real clear is Walter Scott should not have to be morally immaculate to be treated as a decent person, as to be treated with human dignity and respect. Nor should Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, you know, or any of the hashtags that make up the Black Lives Matter movement. They said, we aren't going to play that respectability politics game. You know, you look at all of us as in this together, you know, and we're standing in solidarity with the least of us. Now, none of us deserves state-imposed brutality of any kind. So, yeah, this is one of the reasons I use the N-word, too, is many people who practice respectability politics are especially upset by the N-word. You know, they're the ones who went after gangster rap in the 90s and even the late 80s and said that it was such a scourge and it needed to be eliminated from the community. Police would actually arrest Ice Cube on stage. When I interviewed him after my play, he said when he said these words, he was told by police officers he would be arrested, and they would. And these are the words he was arrested for, Sonali. Police coming straight from the underground. A young nigga got it bad because I'm brown and not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority. You listen to all the lyrics of that song. It's a political song, very much, right? It's a political anthem. And to characterize it as something that is worthy of arrest and jailing tells you what's at stake. That's one of the other reasons I use the N-word. When we're talking about transgressive, uncomfortable language, symbolic communication or non-symbolic communication, how much power should we give the state to regulate that speech? You know, when we're trying to regulate hate speech, might we unwittingly give the state the power to come in and regulate people like me, Armor, and say, oh, that N-word, we're going to call that hate speech, and we're going to crack down on you, and then we're going to crack down on all these other Black dissidents and Black dissenters. I worry about giving the state that kind of power, anybody that kind of power, in the name of hate speech regulation.
Judy, you're an academic, and you write in your book the experience that you had when you first began using the N-word in an academic setting, why you made the conscious decision, and the reaction that it elicited. I imagine that might have been the beginning of the journey that started this book that you've just written.
Yeah, it did. It started the book I've written, that, you know, the linguistic use of the N-word as that kind of a rather linguistic form of symbolic communication. The non-linguistic form is the Afro I've grown as a result of writing this book, and I'll talk to you more about that perhaps a little later.
Right, for our TV audience, they would know what you're saying, but maybe our radio audience can find our interview online and watch it.
Yes, I have a big Afro that I've been rocking since high school, actually.
It's beautiful.
Thank you. But it's gotten me some side glances and made me look a lot more suspicious, frankly, to a lot of people. But I started using the N-word at American Association of Law School's annual conference back in 1999. I was supposed to address this Tweedy assemblage of law professors about criminal justice matters. You know, as I was writing about social cognition research and information processing approaches to human cognition and the cognitive unconscious and all that kind of stuff back then. But before I went, I had to go down to Terminal Island down in San Pedro and address the guards about unconscious bias there. And I was given a tour of the cell grounds, and I saw all the faces looking at me from the bars, behind the bars. They reminded me of my own dad, who was behind bars for 5 years, the people I grew up with. So by the time I got to New Orleans, to give my AALS annual speech, I wasn't feeling like a lot of genteel language, you know, calcified language of the academy. And so I told them as much, and then I broke into 16 bars of N-word laden gangster rap from Ice Cube's America's Most Wanted, with lines kicking street knowledge, why more niggas in the pen than in college. Because of that line, I must be your cellmate. That's from the nigga you love to hate. And a lot of other lines that were politically laced, but also profane and deliberately disruptive. The reason I was doing it is for the same reasons Black Lives Matter adopted the methodology that it adopted in 2013, 14, and 15. It's two kind of, I think, signature methodologies are: one, disruption. Let's shut it down. Let's cut through our collective complacency about this, you know, racial oppression, this burning issue. And then number two, let's have some uncomfortable conversation once we shut it down. And so, for me, that N-word was disruptive. And you could imagine in that academic setting, among those sedate colleagues, it was quite disruptive. The break into 16 bars of nigga you love to hate. And it compelled some uncomfortable conversations. And so that's why I used it back then. And I'm drawing on that same spirit with this book now.
Who should use it? And that is a big question in America today. There was a time when white folks thought it was okay for them to use it, and they would say that it was okay for them to use the N-word, because if black folks could use it, so should they, freedom of speech, etc. White comedians have gotten in trouble for using it. Then there becomes this the beginning of this whole discourse about who should be allowed to say it, or who should, you know, be sanctioned in being able to use the word. And it also raises questions about black identity, right? Who is quote unquote black enough?
Raises all those questions, which is why one of the other reasons it has to be in the title of the book, because the book is about that. I have a whole chapter dedicated to just reflections on language, ordinary language philosophy. So we get a chance to sort some of these questions out and think them through. And but at the end of the day, I'm going to give you the summary, the executive summary version of it, Sonali. Non-black people should not be using the word. If you've been a member of the category that has been historically the target of the epithet, you are then in a position to use said epithet, that same epithet, with irony, in a way that nobody who has not been the historical target of that epithet cannot use it, right? You can invert its meaning and transvalue its meaning in a way that someone who has not been the historical point of that violent epithet, you know, simply can't. So that is what, that's the quick and dirty. Also, I understand that it's a powerful cultural property. And a lot of white people do want to appropriate it. You know, people like Bill Maher would love to sprinkle his punchlines with the N-word. And if he could get away with it, he would, because it's that powerful as a cultural property. When Kanye West said, I ain't saying she's a gold digger, but she ain't messing with no broke, you know, when he added the N-word to the end of that couplet, he added hundreds of thousands of sales to his bottom line, right? Because it's a word with that kind of, it's unparaphrasable power, that kind of cultural cachet, right? And power to it, and sharpness and edginess and all the rest, that yes, a lot of white folks would love to start appropriating it and using it. And this is one time they can, and some of them are upset about it, but sometimes you're just going to have to, if you find yourself having those kinds of temptations, take it as a moment of zen and sit back and say, at some point, maybe I shouldn't be privileged to just, you know, appropriate everything all the time. You know, maybe there should be some kind of reasonable limits to what I have the power to appropriate. And if this may be one of them.
How can the discussion around language and race be a doorway toward transforming our criminal justice system, because at the end of the day, we're talking about far too many human beings locked up in our nation's prisons who are disproportionately Black.
Yes. And the N-word, more than any other word I can think of in the English language. There's no other word like it. It more otherizes its referent than any other word I can think of. It more monsterizes, demonizes, otherizes its referent more than any other word I can think of. And that's especially what we do, not only to Black folk generally, but to criminals in particular, and to Black criminals in particular, right? I mean, the most distilled, most concentrated form of otherness and unworthiness in the American imagination is a Black criminal, a criminal who's Black. That combination of concentrated, stereotype-laden otherness, you know, is why, another reason I use the N-word, and that's how we think about prisoners. So often we just think of them as so much toxic human waste that are to be dumped somewhere and forgotten. We don't have any real care and concern for them. Not only, you know, do we not have the kind of care and concern that we have for Black people in general, which we showed in Katrina when we left those people standing in the Ninth Ward for 4 days without any help. And you compare that to our response to the 9/11 victims in New York, and there was a panic of empathy for them. The Black lives after Katrina just did not matter. That's why for 4 days, FEMA couldn't get its act together to go help them. But we're not just talking about that kind of indifference that white America has shown toward Black America generally. But now you have a kind of also otherness rooted in the fact that you committed a criminal act, and therefore you are a wicked criminal. You're morally condemnable. You know, you aren't just an innocent civil rights era victim of Jim Crow segregation in the South. You know, no, you actually went out and did something. You hurt somebody. You may have preyed on the most vulnerable member of your own community. And that's what's really going on in our prison system. Contrary to what Michelle Alexander says in the new Jim Crow, we did not get to from 300,000 prisoners in 1980 to 2.2 million by the late aughts by arresting and convicting a lot of low-level nonviolent drug offenders. Most of them are violent and serious. That's just the reality. And so if you're going to make deep cuts in racialized mass incarceration, you're going to have to make how you look at these people undergo a fundamental change. You're going to have to yourself undergo a fundamental change in how you look at them, think about them, talk about them, and talking about them. In other words, when you niggerize them, in the way that Chris Rock does, when he says, "I love Black people, but I hate niggers," when you use that word in that way, you are facilitating this whole process of making it acceptable for us to treat these people in the way that we're now treating them. You know where the hotbed right now, the epicenter of outbreaks of COVID-19 are all around the nation? In prisons, by far. I think out of the top 20 places, it's either 17 or 18 of them are prisons and jails. It's outrageous. Or certainly the top 15. I don't want to exaggerate in any way because it's jaw-dropping just as it is. And we don't care about it because we've niggerized them. And that's what I'm trying to get at.
Jody, I am also wondering how important it is, of course, for us to understand that that word, of course, originates in American history, linked to the very American institution of enslavement of Black people. And that historical context is, you know, obvious. It's obvious, but it's also sometimes lost. It's also been swept under the rug because today's white conservative Trump-loving America wants to cleanse itself off of any culpability because that is past, that's history. So how does that word link the historical origins of this nation with existing current racism?
Oh, it does very plainly. You're exactly right. Etymologically, it has deep roots running into a blood-soaked racist past where people like me were chattel slaves, for people like Thomas Jefferson and George Washington. And that I hear those echoes in the word whenever I hear it uttered, on the one hand. On the other, I also hear the defiant, the defiant refusal to submit to that status when I hear someone like Tupac say in one of his dirges, "How many brothers fell victim to the street? Rest in peace, young nigga, there's a heaven for a G. I'd be a lie if I told you that I never thought of death. My niggas, we the last ones left." When he's talking, using the word "my niggas" in that language, in that context, there are no stronger terms of endearment or words of solidarity, right? And so it is a double-edged word in that way. It can both reject and accept. It can embrace and push away. And it's part of what language itself is all about. You know, I tell my students all the time, we're word workers. The four occupations in America with bread and butter is word work: writers, poets, rappers, and lawyers. And so, and I got all that from my dad, you know, who was locked up. He was looking at 22 to 55 for possession and sale of marijuana. And all he had was word work between him and rotting in a jail cell. He put those words together in the right order. And the next thing you know, Armour versus Salisbury, I teach it in my criminal law class. He's walking a free man because of the power of language. And so I want us to constantly think about the power of language. Think about Toni Morrison when she says, you know, we die, that may be the meaning of life, but we do language. That may be the measure of our lives. So certainly that's what part of the other reason the N-word's in the title.
Well, Jody, we could talk about this for so much longer, but I highly encourage our audience to pick up a copy of your book and read it themselves. I will not say it. Please say it again so people know where they can find it.
Sure, absolutely. Nigga Theory, Race, Language, Unequal Justice in the Law, Amazon, you know, the usual suspects, LARB Books, all the usual suspects. Thanks so much, Sonali. It's always great talking to you.
The book has a foreword by Larry Krasner and an introduction by, a foreword by Melina Abdullah and an introduction by Larry Krasner. Jody, thank you so much and good luck with the book.
Thank you.
My guest has been Jody Armour, the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Law at the University of Southern California. He is also the race and criminal justice correspondent for our program. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.